This is a cybersecurity and cryptocurrency podcast. And now, here's your host, Eric English.
Welcome. Today is September the 14th, 2018. It's a Friday. Good Friday to everybody. Hope everybody's doing good this week. There's been some interesting developments with Ethereum we're going to talk about, and also have some cybersecurity news topics we're going to touch on as well. So we'll kick it off today with some cybersecurity stuff. Kind of big news that's been reported on several different sites is the new Cold Boot attack that they've just uncovered, and they say basically it affects all computers. So encrypting your computer's hard drive is basically pointless because of this attack. And what the attack does, with a specially crafted, if it's a USB device, they can pull your encryption keys from your memory while the computer is in an off state or just booting up. So obviously, if you have the encryption keys, you can decrypt the hard drive, right? So this cold boot attack is getting a lot of press because, you know, similar to Spectre and Meltdown, this affects all computers. So this, yet again, is a big hardware flaw that manufacturers are going to have to deal with. So you will see some firmware updates from manufacturers regarding this in the upcoming weeks. Certainly crazy to think about with the Spectre Meltdown stuff and now this, basically rendering your hard drive encryption completely pointless. It's a headache for security people. It really, really is. It's just one more thing that we have to worry about. One more thing that we have to try to fix now. So it's not going to be easy if you're a cybersecurity pro and you're in charge of patching all this stuff. It's definitely not going to be easy. But, you know, and also, just like with anything, the scenario has to be perfect, right? So an attacker has to, number one, get your computer from you. So they have to have physical access. They have to also know how to do this attack and have the specially crafted devices that can pull these encryption keys from memory. So, you know, it's a perfect world kind of scenario, right? So there are other ways to mitigate this outside of firmware updates. So if you stop and think about it, just preventing physical access to all of your systems that are, you know, have encrypted hard drives. Now, if your hard drives aren't encrypted, you probably don't even care about this one. But if you're using BitLocker or anything else, this definitely applies to you. So, heads up, this is definitely going to be talked about quite a bit. But just think about it this way. If you prevent physical access to your system, you know, it's a moot point, essentially. But it's been getting a lot of press over the last few days. They're comparing the impact to Spectre and Meltdown. Although Spectre and Meltdown, you know, impact was huge, the results that you get from Spectre Meltdown attacks are very minimal. You know, yes, they have found quicker ways to get the information, but it's not, you know, all that fast. And you're getting random bits of information, so you have to really, you know, be waiting and listening and be on someone's system for quite a while to really be able to get anything worthwhile. So that was interesting stuff. I'll post the link to the cold boot attack in the show notes if you want to check that out. It's definitely been a big article. If your systems don't leave your office and they're unencrypted, this obviously doesn't matter for you. Or if they are encrypted and they don't leave your office or whatever, and you lock your office in the evenings, it's pretty low impact, low risk. But if, you know, most days in most companies, everybody's got a laptop. And hopefully, if you're a good cybersecurity person, you've encrypted those laptops. So stay on top of this one and wait to see kind of fixes come out for this, because they will release firmware upgrades and whatnot from the manufacturers. But it's just one more thing that we all have to patch and update. It's kind of a pain. So keep that in the back of your mind and keep watching that. Some other cybersecurity stuff. I saw a really cool post from Google Project Zero. So Google has their own security testing team. They call it Project Zero. And they released some of their open source tools. You can find them all on GitHub, and I'll post a link to them. But it's just more hacker tools that are out there freely available. And Google Project Zero has found quite a bit on their own. And it's been kind of controversial in some instances because they've disclosed vulnerabilities without, you know, letting the software makers or whoever patch it before they release the information about the vulnerability. So it's certainly been controversial, but they are now releasing their tools. I think they probably had them out there for a while on GitHub. I just never seen them. But it's cool to see it now, and you know, just cool stuff to tinker around with if you're into the ethical hacking type of stuff. Some other news, there's a Russian hacker that pled guilty to operating the Kelios botnet, and he pled guilty. He's being extradited to the United States, so one more Russian hacker in the books, and no longer hacking America. Great. This is one guy. One guy. Come on. We need a lot more than that. They're doing a lot more than that. There's thousands and thousands and thousands of other hackers that are still out there hacking away. But they got this one guy, and they also got the North Korea guy for the WannaCry stuff. I have a hard time believing that WannaCry was just one person. I don't know why. Maybe he's just taking the fall for everybody. And maybe he did write it by himself. I mean, who knows? These guys are smart as hell, so maybe it was just him. It just seems kind of odd that he was the only person responsible for all of the WannaCry outbreaks. You know, was he the only one phishing people? Was he the only one sending this out? Is he the only one that wrote the code? Is that what it is? Is that why he's solely responsible? Is because he wrote the code? Or did he do all of the phishing and all of the infecting and everything by himself? I find it a little hard to believe that he did it all by himself, but I guess that's another story for another day. And similar to this, to the Russian hacker that's pleading guilty to this botnet, was it really just him? One guy's doing all this? I mean, yeah, it's possible, but you know, you'd think it'd be an army of hackers that are doing this kind of stuff. But anyway, thought that was kind of interesting. Other cybersecurity news. It's been out for a while, and I've talked about it a little bit on here too, but the remote desktop attacks that are going on and still going on, and hackers are using this to exploit and install ransomware on remote systems. So if you don't already know this, here's your PSA. All right, do not open up remote desktop to the internet ever, period. This is a great way to get infected with ransomware. If you open up any system to the internet, open up remote desktop, any system to the internet, you're basically asking to get hacked. So if you need remote access to a system, and most system admins do, you got to do your job, right? Well, get on the VPN first and then remote desktop to whatever system it is that you need to administer. Do not open up RDP to the internet. That's just a horrible idea. There were some statistics about how many people got infected just with this one tactic, just because remote desktop was available externally. So don't fall victim to the same thing that everybody else did. Close off remote desktop. It's port 3389. And I don't care if you change the remote desktop port to something else, it's still remote desktop. A hacker can still fingerprint it and know that remote desktop is running on that port. It doesn't matter if you change it to a high port. Don't do it at all. Make everybody get on a VPN first and then remote desktop. That is the safest way to remote into your system. I mean, unless you want to get ransomware, then yeah, go ahead. Open it up. It's cool. But there's also some other mitigating tactics that you need to do when using remote desktop. First and foremost, RDP over TLS is probably one of the biggest ones. If you're not using remote desktop over TLS, or you don't have it configured correctly, you could be sending your credentials in plain text. Most people save their credentials, their RDP credentials, in their shortcut for remote desktop. So what this does, if RDP over TLS is not configured correctly, or not configured at all, or even turned on, the credentials are passed to the remote server in plain text. So what does that mean for you? If you're on a public Wi-Fi, a free Wi-Fi, and you have your RDP credentials saved in your remote desktop shortcut, and you are not on a VPN, don't have RDP over TLS, you're going to get hacked. That's clear as day. Because somebody at that coffee shop is going to be watching everybody. They're going to be doing ARP spoofing and capturing every packet they possibly can. And they're going to see your RDP credentials floating over the wire in plain text. RDP over TLS is so important to turn on if you haven't already. Another good thing to turn on for remote desktop, if you can, is to turn on some sort of two-factor to get into those systems via remote desktop. It just adds another layer onto those systems. Okta, for example, has a plugin that does this. Duo has a plugin that does this as well. Other software vendors do as well. And I think even Microsoft, through their Azure Single Sign-On, I want to say they've got it there too. So Azure Single Sign-On, if you're utilizing that, you can also, I believe, set up two-factor to get onto your systems. So that's a great, great idea for anybody using remote desktop. But, you know, first and foremost, get on the VPN first. I mean, that's going to prevent a lot of these attacks from happening. But, you know, if you're not going to be on a VPN or you accidentally forget to not connect to the VPN and you're doing RDP over TLS or not doing RDP over TLS, you're sending your credentials in plain text. And it's pretty obvious that somebody's going to be able to hack you if you're on a public Wi-Fi. So don't be that guy if you can. It's not easy, I know. But secure remote desktop as much as you can if you have to use it. All right. So let's see, what else did we have for cybersecurity? I think that was it for cybersecurity news. As far as cryptocurrencies go, Ethereum announced today that they are doing their hard fork testing in October. That's the big code upgrade that they're going to do in October. So they did come out and formally announce it will be live on their test net in October. I forget what they call the release now. They gave it kind of a cool name, but Ethereum is doing that fork, and that should be interesting to see, you know, how that does and see what big changes are actually happening, if any at all. So that'll be really cool. But it's coming up on their testnet here pretty soon, so be on the lookout for that if you're an Ethereum fan. Good news, too, for Ethereum. You know, I was talking about it was tanking the other day. Well, it's back up a little bit, so that's good. It did go back up a little bit. It's up around 200 now. So it's not totally the end of the world, although the outlook is still kind of gloomy. But hopefully with their code upgrade in October and, you know, the market rebounding a little bit, their value will go back up. So we'll see what happens in October. But I've been doing a lot of trading lately, and I wanted to talk about which coins to invest in and how to spot a good one to invest in and how trading works on some of these exchanges. So it's very different for every single coin out there, and there's a lot of things to consider and a lot of things to keep in mind. So I'm going to kind of briefly run through the things that I've learned just in the last few weeks that I've been heavily getting into trading. The spread is so important. The spread is basically the difference between what somebody is willing to buy it for versus what somebody is willing to sell it for. The difference is called the spread. So a seller might want to sell it for $10 and the buyer only wants to pay $2. There's an $8 spread. Okay, so the smaller the spread, the better it is for trading, because if the spread is huge, there's not going to be a lot of active trading because people don't want to pay whatever it is, and they don't want to sell at such a low rate, they don't want to buy at such a high rate. So if the spread is huge, people aren't going to be trading it as much or as frequently. So what does that mean? Well, that means if you place an order to buy or sell, it may not get filled for days, until somebody finally gets desperate enough to come up and buy it or sell it, whatever it is. So keep an eye on the spread when you're looking at these coins, especially the young coins that have only been around, you know, a few months versus, you know, years and years. The younger the coin, the less activity, the less daily activity on the markets, and the bigger the spread are kind of the red flags to look out for. So if you're looking at some coins to invest in that are new, look at the spread before you do anything and see how big that difference is. Also, look at daily trading volume. If it's, you know, in the $100,000 range of daily trading, that's good. There's a lot of active trading going on. That also means the spread is probably pretty small as well, so that's good. That means that your buy and sell orders will get filled rather quickly. So, also on some of these exchanges, I've signed up for damn near every single one of them now. There's one called Crex24, GraviX, Crypto Bridge, several others. And you can kind of tell when a coin is listed on some of these exchanges and you're kind of like, I don't know, this coin looks kind of sketchy. And I've, at least in my experience, I've seen that a lot of the things, besides the big name coins, a lot of the coins that are listed on CryptoBridge seem to be a little sketchy. That's just my experience with it. It could just be me and just what I've been researching lately, but it seems like a lot of the coins on there, especially the lower level coins on there, are a little sketchy and probably not worth investing in. But most of the other exchanges are good, as far as I can tell, for investing. Haven't really seen any huge red flags, but... So, for example, if you're mining for whatever crypto and you're going onto the exchange to sell it, and you might be mining for a coin that's fairly new, and you know you're mining for it, you've got a stockpile of it, and you want to go out there to the exchange and you want to sell it, be very careful, because there's a lot of people out there that will take advantage of newbies, and they will put in buy orders for an extremely low price, like, you know, fractions of a penny. But they'll put in their buy order for, you know, hundreds of thousands of these coins, whatever it is, but they'll put it in for fractions of a penny when the coin is worth, you know, let's say a dollar, for example. So, you know, to me, it's kind of like trolling on the exchanges, I guess you could call it that. But they're putting in these buy orders for such low prices. And it could really fool somebody if you don't know what you're looking at. And you see, oh, this guy's going to buy it. He wants to buy, you know, 10,000 of these coins. I'll just sell to him. And you don't realize the price, you're going to get screwed. So be very, very careful when you're going to these exchanges and you're selling. Make sure you know what you want to sell it for. Look at the current market value and sell it for that. Don't short sell yourself, because when you do, that actually brings the value of that coin down. The more short selling that people do, the value just goes down and down and down. Now, short selling is when the sellers are willing to take a whole lot less than what they normally would take, or a whole lot less than what everybody else is taking. So that's the short sell. And they call it a short sell because you're shorting yourself. You're taking less than what everybody else is taking. So don't get impatient. You have to be patient and wait and get the price that you want. Don't short sell it, because that makes the price of that particular coin and the value of that coin go down for everybody else. The other problem with a lot of these exchanges, there's a lot of bots that are on these exchanges that are manipulating prices. And this is another reason why there needs to be some sort of regulation with crypto, especially on these exchanges. There's all these bots on there that are buying and selling at these weird rates, and it brings the value, you know, depending on what they're trying to do, it could bring the value way up or it could bring the value way down. They'll create a bunch of short sells, for example, and bring the value of that coin down. Then they'll buy a whole bunch. Then, you know, when the price is down, they'll buy a whole bunch. And then they tell their bots to go bring the value back up. So as the price of that coin goes back up to wherever they want, then they sell all of the coin that they bought when it was at its lowest rate. So they're manipulating the market. And typically, they call them whales, but it's the people with a whole lot of money that can manipulate these markets. They're usually pretty damn good at it. If you've got, you know, you're playing around with millions of bucks in the exchanges, you can create quite a bit of up and down trends just by yourself. Now, with Bitcoin, that's a different story. You obviously wouldn't be able to do that much damage because Bitcoin's in the billions. But if you sell $1 million worth of Bitcoin, you know, that can definitely have a small effect. But if you sell $1 million of a smaller coin, let's say like, I don't know, music coin, for example, that one's not even worth all that much. But if you sell $1 million worth of that, you could really, really, really create a price drop there. So moral of the story is to, you know, you're in control if you're the seller, right? And a lot of these exchanges, they'll tell you how much people are trying to buy, like how many total coins people are trying to buy versus how many total coins are being sold. And on a lot of these, from what I've seen, there's a lot more buyers than there are sellers. So what does that mean? That means the buyers have the control of the price, but they'll get desperate. I'm sorry, the sellers have control of the price, and they get desperate, and they end up selling it for a lower rate. So if you're the one selling, you have control over what you're going to sell it for. Don't short sell yourself, because you're going to make it tank for everybody else. Wait, put in your sell order, and just wait. The Ethereum fork, by the way, is called Constantinople. I just remembered that. So kind of going back and forth on topics there. Sorry about that. But Constantinople is the new fork that Ethereum's going to do. Pretty cool stuff. Got kind of a crossover story. Brave, the browser company, they filed some litigation with somewhere in the UK regarding how Google and I believe it was Apple use their ad money and their ad tracking and whatnot, and how they use the data from that. As you know, Brave blocks all those ads, so that's really nice. And you don't see a bunch of the crap that's on all these web pages. I like to go to CNET News a lot, and it's brutal with all their freaking ads. It makes their pages load so damn slow. But if you use the Brave browser, it blocks all those ads, and the site is actually functional. It's amazing. So if you haven't tried Brave, I highly recommend it. But Brave also created their own token called Bat Token, which is available in the browser itself. Buy your Bat Token in the browser. And what Brave is trying to do with that BAT token, I think we've talked about it before, but they're trying to basically allow you to pay the sites that you go to in BAT token versus the sites having to run ads and drive you nuts. So it's kind of a cool concept. I don't think a lot of people are doing that yet, but apparently Brave didn't like the way that, you know, Google and whatnot was using all the ad data that they're getting from all of their ads that they post. Google does tons and tons of advertising, so most of the sites you go to are typically going to be a Google provided ad. So I thought that was kind of interesting. I'll post a link to that too. There's also a new for Ethereum. There's a new technique called sharding. Apparently, I have no idea what this does, but one of the major Ethereum coders came up with this new technique called sharding. No, it's not sharding. It's sharding. Big difference there. But that has recently come out as well from Ethereum. So I'm assuming that that's going to be part of the new test that they do on their testnet in October. So I thought that was kind of interesting as well for Ethereum. So big news there for Ethereum. I have a feeling that will drive some of their prices up a little bit, but we shall see. Let's see some other news here. Oh, sorry, I did have another cybersecurity topic, too. I saw some research papers on VLAN hopping, and I don't think that's something that we've talked about on this show yet, the VLAN hopping, but I want to reinforce how important it is to physically segment your networks. I'll post the article to the show notes so everybody can look at it, but essentially, VLAN hopping is where you are on one VLAN. You know, typically, you create VLANs to separate traffic, like for voice and data, as an example. Well, oftentimes, when I used to do pen testing, I would go in and get on their voice network, and then VLAN hop over to their primary data network. And once you've hopped over to their data network, you can pretty much do anything and everything that you wanted to. You can do ARP spoofing, you can do poisoning, everything that you want to do to capture passwords and anything else that you can think of. So VLAN hopping is extremely popular. There's a tool called VoIP Hopper that is not talked about in this article. VoIP Hopper was actually written by one of my coworkers. It's built into Kali Linux, but it's specifically designed for hopping from a voice VLAN to a non-voice VLAN, like your data VLAN. So VoIP Hopper is not talked about in the article, but they do mention a couple other tools that are also built into Kali for VLAN hopping. So it's extremely easy to do these VLAN hops, and a lot of people don't believe in it. They don't think it's real. They don't think it can happen, but all it takes is one misconfigured VLAN, and it makes it just extremely easy to VLAN hop. So they do also in the article, they talk about mitigations and how to stop this. But they were talking about too that the trunking that the switches do can cause or can make it easier to do the VLAN hopping. So if you configured any of your switch ports to do trunking, that can actually make it easier to do the VLAN hopping. But trunking is essentially where you have connected multiple switches together, and the trunking allows it to send traffic from all VLANs through that trunk to another switch or to another part of the network, to a router or whatever. But that trunking is actually what helps create a vulnerability there. So because that trunk is essentially allowing all the VLANs, so if you are able to see what's going on that trunking port, then you can do this VLAN hopping pretty easily. So for anybody out there that has a guest Wi-Fi network and it's just VLAN off, I can't stress enough how important it is to physically segment that guest network, because the right hacker with the right tools can easily VLAN hop to your primary data network. It's just really scary. And people don't think that it's possible. They don't think it's doable. It's very doable and very possible and actually very easy to do. VoIP Hopper is so extremely easy. It's laughable how easy it is. And there's, like I said, there's a lot of other tools for VLAN hopping that are out there as well. But certainly have to physically segment any untrusted networks. And, you know, physically segmenting, meaning it's not touching any part of your primary network whatsoever. It's on its own separate internet connection and everything. I've seen techniques where people put the guest network in a DMZ, which, you know, I guess that's okay. It still, you know, in my mind, still needs to be physically segmented from your network completely on its own wire, on its own internet connection, just completely separate. So check out that VLAN hopping article. And if you're one of the ethical hackers out there, check out these tools in Kali to help you do the VLAN hopping. And check out VoIP Hopper. It's not talked about in this article, but check out VoIP Hopper as well. Very cool stuff, but scary for system admins and security admins when you've got guest networks that are just segmented with VLANs. So make sure you're protecting yourself as best you can on those VLANs. All right, folks, that's all I had for today. It's a nice Friday. Go home and relax and tinker around with some more crypto stuff over the weekend, some buying and trading and whatnot. So I hope everybody has a great weekend, and we will talk next week.